Dreamscape presents Echopraxia by Peter Watts. Narrated by Adam J. Ruff. We do not destroy religion by destroying superstition. Cicero. To concentrate on heaven is to create hell. Tom Robbins. We climbed this hill. Each step up, we could see farther, so of course we kept going. Now we're at the top. Science has been at the top for a few centuries now, and we look out across the plain and we see this other tribe dancing around above the clouds, even higher than we are. Maybe it's a mirage, maybe it's a trick, or maybe they just climbed a higher peak we can't see because the clouds are blocking the view. So we head off to find out. But every step takes us downhill. No matter what direction we head, we can't move off our peak without losing our vantage point. So we climb back up again. We're trapped on a local maximum. But what if there is a higher peak out there, way across the plain? The only way to get there is bite the bullet, come down off our foothill, and trudge along the riverbed until we finally start going uphill again. And it's only then you realize, hey, this mountain reaches way higher than that foothill we were on before, and we can see so much better from up here. But you can't get there unless you leave behind all the tools that made you so successful in the first place. You have to take that first step downhill. Dr. Liana Lutterote, Faith and the Fitness Landscape, In Conversation, 2091. Prelude. It is almost impossible systematically to constitute a natural moral law. Nature has no principles. She furnishes us with no reason to believe that human life is to be respected. Nature, in her indifference, makes no distinction between good and evil. Anatole France. A white room, innocent of shadow or topography. No angles, that's crucial. No corners or intrusions of furniture. No directional lighting. No geometries of light and shadow, whose intersection, from any viewpoint, might call forth the sign of the cross. The wall, was a single curved surface, softly bioluminescent. A spheroid enclosure flattened at the bottom in grudging deference to biped convention. It was a giant womb 3 meters across, right down to the whimpering thing curled up on the floor. A womb, with all the blood on the outside. Her name was Sachita Bar, and all that blood was in her head, too. By now, they'd killed the cameras, just like everything else. But there was no way to take back the images from those first moments. The lounge, the histo lab, even the broom closet, for Christ's sakes. A grungy little cubby on the third floor where Gregor had hidden. Sachi hadn't been watching when Gregor had been found. She'd been flipping through the channels, frantically scanning for life, and finding only the dead. Their insides all out now. By the time she had cycled through to the closet feed, the monsters had already been and gone. Gregor, who was in love with that stupid pet ferret of his. She'd shared an elevator with him this morning. She remembered the stripes on his shirt. Otherwise, she'd have had no idea what to call the mess in the closet. She'd seen some fraction of the carnage before the cameras went down. Friends and colleagues and rivals cut down without remorse or favoritism. Their gutted remains sprawled across lab benches and workstations and toilet stalls. And with all those feeds running through the implants in her head, with all her access to all that ubiquitous surveillance, Sachita Bar had not caught so much as a glimpse of the creatures who'd done this. Shadows, at most. A flicker of darkness cast by some solitary stalker from a blind spot in the camera's eye. They'd done it all without ever being seen, without ever seeing each other. They'd always been kept isolated, For their own good, of course. Stick two vampires in the same room, and their own hardwired territoriality would put them at each other's throats in an instant. And yet, they were working together somehow. At least half a dozen, confined, incommunicado, acting in sudden, precise concert. They'd done it all without ever meeting face to face, and even at the height of the slaughter, in those last moments before the cameras died, they had remained invisible. The whole massacre had happened from the corner of Sachi's eye. How did they do it? How did they survive the angles? Someone else might have enjoyed the irony. She hid in a refuge for monsters, one of the few places in the whole damn building where they could open their eyes without risking a death sentence. Right angles were verboten here. This was where Achilles' heels were put to the test, a cross-free zone where geometry was precisely controlled and neurological leashes optimized. Elsewhere, civilized geometry threatened on all sides. Tabletops, window panes, a million intersections of appliance and architecture just waiting for the right viewpoint to send vampires into convulsions. Those monsters wouldn't, shouldn't, last an hour out there without the anti-Euclideans that suppressed the crucifix glitch. Only here, in the white womb, where poor, stupid Sachi Tabar had run when the lights went out, could they dare to open unprotected eyes. And now one of them was in here with her. She couldn't see it. Her own eyes were shut, squeezed tight against the butchery flash-burned into her head. She heard no sound but the endless animal keening in her own throat. But something drank a little of the light falling on her face. The swirling red darkness inside her eyelids dimmed some infinitesimal telltale fraction, and she knew. "Hello," it said. She opened her eyes. It was one of the females. Valerie, they'd named her, after some departmental chairman who'd retired the year before. Valerie the vampire. Valerie's eyes redshifted the light and threw it back at her. Blood-orange stars in a face flushed with aftermath. She towered over Sachi like an insectile statue, motionless, even her breathing imperceptible. Moments from death, and with nothing better to do, some subroutine in Sachi's head ticked off the morphometrics. Such inhumanly long limbs, the attenuate heat-dissipating allometry of a metabolic engine running hot. Subtly jutting mandible, lupine as a hominid's could be, to hold all those teeth. Stupid turquoise smock, smart paper telemetry composite weave. Valerie must have been scheduled for physio work today. Ruddy complexion, the bloody flash-flood vasodilation of the predator and hunting mode. And the eyes, those terrifying luminous pinpoints, finally it registered. Contracted pupils. She's not on anti-U. Suddenly, Sachi's cross was out. Last-ditch kill switch. The talisman everyone got on day one, along with their ID. Empirically tested, proven in the crunch, redeemed by science, after uncounted centuries spent slumming as a religious fetish. Sachi held it up with sudden, desperate bravado, thumbed the stud. Spring-loaded extensions shot from each tip, and her little pocket totem was suddenly a meter on a side. 30 degrees of visual arc, Sachi. Maybe 40 for the tough ones. Make sure it's perpendicular to line of sight. The angles only work when they're close to 90 degrees, but once this little baby covers enough arc, the visual cortex fries like a circuit in a shitstorm. Greg's words. Valerie cocked her head and studied the artifact. Any second now, Sachi knew, this nightmare creature would collapse in a twitching mass of tetany and shorting synapses. That wasn't faith. It was neurology. The monster leaned close and didn't even shiver. Sachi Tabar pissed herself. "Please," she sobbed. The vampire said nothing. Words flooded out. "I'm sorry. I was never really part of it, you know.
I'm just a research associate. I'm just doing it for my degree, that's all. And I know it's wrong. I know it's like slavery almost. I know that, and it's a shitty system. It's a shitty thing we did to you. But it wasn't really me, do you understand? I didn't make any of those decisions. I just came in afterward. I'm barely involved. It was just for my degree. And I can understand how you must feel. I can understand why you'd hate us. I would too, probably, but please, oh please. I'm just a student.
After a while, still alive, she dared to look up again. Valerie was staring at some point just to the left and 1,000 light years away. She seemed distracted, but then they always seemed distracted, their minds running 12 parallel threads simultaneously, 12 perceptual realities, each every bit as real as the one mere humans occupied. Valerie cocked her head as if listening to faint music. She almost smiled.
Please,
Saatchi whispered. Not angry, Valerie said. Don't want revenge. You don't matter.
You don't, but...
Bodies, blood, a building full of corpses and the monsters who'd made them.
What do you want, then? Anything, please, I'll...
Want you to imagine something. Christ on the cross. And of course, once the image had been incanted, it was impossible not to imagine. Sachita Bar had a few moments to wonder at the sudden spasms seizing her limbs, at the way her jaw locked into startling dislocation, at the feel of 1,000 blood-hot strokes exploding like pinpricks across the back of her skull. She tried to close her eyes, but it doesn't matter what kind of light falls on the retina. That's not vision. The mind generates its own images, much farther upstream, and there's no way to shut those out. Yes, Valerie clicked thoughtfully to herself. I learn. Saatchi managed to speak. It was the hardest thing she'd ever done, but she knew that was fitting. It was also the last thing she would ever do. So she summoned all her willpower, every shred of every reserve, every synapse that hadn't already been commandeered for self-destruction. And she spoke, because nothing else mattered anymore, and she really wanted to know.
Learn what?
She couldn't quite get it out, but the short-circuiting brain of Saatchita Bar managed to serve up one last insight anyway, amid the rising static.
This is what the crucifix glitch feels like. This is what we do to them. This is... judo,
Valerie whispered.
Primitive. Ultimately, all science is correlation. No matter how effectively it may use one variable to describe another, its equations will always ultimately rest upon the surface of a black box. St. Herbert might have put it most succinctly when he observed that all proofs inevitably reduce to propositions that have no proof. The difference between science and faith, therefore, is no more and no less than predictive power. Scientific insights have proven to be better predictors than spiritual ones, at least in worldly matters. They prevail not because they are true, but simply because they work. The bicameral order represents a stark anomaly in this otherwise consistent landscape. Their explicitly faith-based methodologies venture unapologetically into metaphysical realms that defy empirical analysis, yet they yield results with consistently more predictive power than conventional science. How they do this is not known. Our best evidence suggests some kind of rewiring of the temporal lobe in a way that amplifies their connection to the divine. It would be dangerously naive to regard this as a victory for traditional religion. It is not. It is a victory for a radical sect barely half a century old, and the cost of that victory has been to demolish the wall between science and faith. The Church's concession of the physical realm informed the historic armistice that has allowed faith and reason to coexist to this day. One may find it heartening to see faith ascendant once again across the human spectrum, but it is not our faith. Its hand still guides lost sheep away from the soulless empiricism of secular science. But the days in which it guided them into the loving arms of our Savior are waning. An Enemy Within, The Bicameral Threat to Institutional Religion in the 21st Century, An Internal Report to the Holy See by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, 2093. All animals are under stringent selection pressure to be as stupid as they can get away with. Pete Richardson and Robert Boyd. Deep in the Oregon desert, crazy as a prophet, Daniel Brooks opened his eyes to the usual litany of death warrants. It had been a slow night. A half dozen traps on the east side were offline. Damn booster station must have gone down again. And most of the others were empty. But number 18 had caught a garter snake. A sage grouse pecked nervously at the lens in number 13. The video feed from number 4 wasn't working, but judging by mass and thermal, there was probably a juvenile scleroporus scrambling around in there. 23 had caught a hare. Brooks hated doing the hares. They smelled awful when you cut them open. And these days, you almost always had to cut them open. He sighed and described a semicircle with his index finger. The feeds vanished from the skin of his tent. Headlines resolved in their wake, defaulting to past interests. Pakistan's ongoing zombie problem. First anniversary of the Redeemer blowout. A sad, brief obituary for the last wild coral reef. Nothing from Roe. Another gesture, and the fabric lit with soft tactical overlays, skewed to thermal. Public domain, real-time satellite imagery of the Prineville Reserve. His tent squatted in the center of the display. A diffuse, yellow smudge. Cold, crunchy outer shell. Warm, chewy center. No comparable hotspots anywhere else in range. Brooks nodded to himself, satisfied. The world continued to leave him alone. Outside, invisible in the colorless pre-dawn, some small creature skittered away across loose, rattling rock as he emerged. His breath condensed in front of him. Frost crunched beneath his boots, bestowed a faint, transient sparkle to the dusty desert floor. His ATB leaned against one of the scraggly larches guarding the camp, marshmallow tires soft and flaccid. He grabbed mug and filter from their makeshift hook and stepped into the open, down a loose jumble of scree. The vestiges of some half-assed desert stream quenched his thirst at the foot of the slope, slimy and sluggish, and doomed to extinction within the month. Enough to keep one large mammal watered in the meantime. Out across the valley, the bicameral's pet tornado squirmed feebly against a gray eastern sky, but stars were still visible overhead, icy, unwinking, and utterly meaningless. Nothing up there tonight but entropy, and the same imaginary shapes that people had been imposing on nature since they'd first thought to wonder at the heavens. It had been a different desert 14 years ago, a different night, but it had felt the same. Until the moment he'd glanced up, and for a few shattering moments, it had even been a different sky, robbed of all randomness. A sky where every star blazed in brilliant, precise formation, where every constellation was a perfect square, no matter how desperately human imaginations might strain. February 13, 2082, the night of first contact. 62,000 objects of unknown origin, clenching around the world in a great grid, screaming across the radio spectrum as they burned. Brooks remembered the feeling, as though he were witnessing some heavenly coup, a capricious god deposed and order restored. The revolution had only lasted a few seconds. The upstaged constellations had reasserted themselves as soon as those precise friction trails had faded from the upper atmosphere. But the damage had been done, Brooks knew. The sky would never look the same again. That's what he'd thought at the time, anyway. That's what everyone had thought. The whole damn species had come together in the wake of that common threat, even if they didn't know what it was exactly. Even if it hadn't actually threatened anything but humanity's own self-importance. The world had put its petty differences aside, spared no expense, thrown together the best damn ship the 21st century could muster. They'd crewed it with expendable, bleeding edgers and sent them off along some best-guess bearing, carrying a phrase book that spelled, "Take me to your leader," in 1,000 languages. The world had been holding its breath for over a decade now, waiting for the second coming. There'd been no encore, no second act. 14 years is a long time for a species raised on instant gratification. Brooks had never considered himself a great believer in the nobility of the human spirit, but even he had been surprised at how little time it took for the sky to start looking the same as it always had, at the speed with which the world's petty differences returned to the front page. People, he reflected, were like frogs. Take something out of their visual field, and they'd just forget it. The Theseus mission would be well past Pluto by now. If it had found anything, Brooks hadn't heard about it. For his part, he was sick of waiting. He was sick of life on hold, waiting for monsters or saviors to make an appearance. He was sick of killing things, sick of dying inside. 14 years. He wished the world would just hurry up and end. He spent the morning as he'd spent every other for the past 2 months, running his trap lines and poking the things inside in the faint hope of finding some piece of nature left untwisted. The clouds were already closing in by sunrise, before his bike had soaked up a decent charge. He left it behind and ran the transects on foot. It was almost noon by the time he got to the hare, only to find that something had beaten him to the punch. The trap had been torn open and its contents emptied by some other predator who'd lacked even the good grace to leave a blood spatter behind for analysis. The garter snake was still slithering around in number 18, though. A male, one of those brown-on-brown morphs that vanished against the dirt. It writhed in Brooks's grasp, clenched around his forearm like a scaly tentacle. Its scent glands smeared stink across his skin. Brooks drew a few microliters of blood without much hope, plugged them into the barcoder on his belt. He swigged from his canteen while the device worked its magic. Far across the desert, the monastery's tornado had swollen to 3 times its pre-dawn size, pumped by the midday heat. Distance reduced it to a brown thread, an insignificant smoky smudge. But get too close to that funnel, and you'd end up scattered over half the valley. Just the year before, some Ugandan vendetta theocracy had hacked a Transat shuttle out of Dartmouth, sent it through a vortex engine on the outskirts of Johannesburg. Not much but rivets and teeth had come out the other side. The barcoder meeped in plaintive surrender. Too many genetic artifacts for a clean read. Brooks sighed, unsurprised. The little machine could tag any gut parasite from the merest speck of shit, ID any host species from the smallest shred of pure tissue. But pure tissue was so hard to come by these days. There was always something that didn't belong. Viral DNA, engineered for the greater good, but too indiscriminate to stay on target. Special marker genes, designed to make animals glow in the dark when exposed to some toxin the EPA had lost interest in 50 years before. Even DNA computers, custom-built for a specific task, and then tramped carelessly into wild genotypes like muddy footprints on a pristine floor. Nowadays, it seemed like half the technical data on the planet were being stored genetically. Try sequencing a lung fluke
and it was even money whether the base pairs you read would code for protein or the technical specs on the Denver sewer system. It was okay, though. Brooks was an old man, a field man from a day when people could tell what they were looking at by, well, by looking at it. Check the chin shields. Count the fin rays, the hooks on the Scolex. Use your eyes, damn it. At least if you screw up, you've only got yourself to blame, not some dumbass machine that can't tell the difference between cytochrome oxidase and a Shakespearean sonnet. And if the things you're trying to ID happen to live inside other things, you kill the host. You cut it open. Brooks was good at that, too. He'd never got around to liking it much, though. Now he whispered to his latest victim. Shh, sorry. It won't hurt. I promise. And dropped it into the kill sack. He'd found himself doing that a lot lately, murmuring meaningless, comforting lies to victims who couldn't possibly understand what he was saying. He kept telling himself to grow up. In all the billions of years that life had been iterating on this planet, had any predator ever tried to comfort its prey? Had natural death ever been so quick and painless as the killings Dan Brooks inflicted for the greater good? And yet, it still bothered him to see those small, diffuse shadows flopping and squirming behind the translucent white plastic, to hear the soft thumps and hisses as simple minds tried to drive bodies, suddenly and terrifyingly unresponsive, toward some kind of imaginary escape. At least these deaths served a purpose, some constructive end, transcending the disease or predation that nature would have inflicted. Life was a struggle to exist at the expense of other life. Biology was a struggle to understand life. And this particular bit of biology, this study of which he was author, principal, and sole investigator, this was a struggle to use biology to help the very populations he was sampling. These deaths were the closest that Darwin's universe would ever come to altruism. And that, said the little voice that always seemed to boot up at times like this, is so much shit. The only thing you're struggling to do is wring a few more publications out of your grant before the funding dries up. Even if you nailed down every change inflicted on every clade over the past 100 years, even if you quantified species lost down to the molecules, it wouldn't matter. Nobody cares. The only thing you're struggling against is reality. That voice had become his constant companion over the years. He let it rant. Either way, he told it after it had run down, we're a shitty biologist. And while his own guilty plea came easily enough, he could not bring himself to feel shame on that account. It had stopped being a snake by the time he got back to camp. He stretched the limp and lifeless remains along the dissecting tray. 4 seconds with the scissors, and it was gutted, throat to cloaca. 20 more, and the GI and respiratory tracts floated in separate watch glasses. The intestine would have the heaviest parasite load. Brooks loaded the GI tract into the scope and got to work. 20 minutes later, a retinue of flukes and cestodes only half-catalogued. Something exploded in the distance. That's what it sounded like, anyway. The soft, muffled whoomph of far-off ordnance. Brooks rose from his work, panned the desert between spindly, gnarled trunks. Nothing, nothing, oh, wait. The monastery. He grabbed his goggles off the ATB and zoomed in. The tornado was the first thing to draw his eye. That thing's going pretty strong for so late in the day. But off to the right, directly over the monastery itself, a puff of dark brown smoke roiled and drifted and dissipated in the lowering light. The building didn't seem to be damaged, though, at least none of the facades he could see. What are they doing over there? Physics, officially. Cosmology. High energy stuff.
But it was all supposed to be theoretical. As far as Brooks knew, the bicameral order didn't perform actual experiments. Of course, hardly anyone did these days. It was machines that scanned the heavens, machines that probed the space between atoms, machines that asked the questions and designed the experiments to answer them. All that was left for mere meat, apparently, was navel-gazing, to sit in the desert and contemplate whatever answers those machines served up, although most still preferred to call it analysis. A hive mind that spoke in tongues. That was how the bicamerals did it, supposedly. Some kind of bio-radio in their heads. A communal corpus callosum. Electrons jiggling around in microtubules. Some kind of quantum entanglement thing. Completely organic, to get around the ban on B2B interfaces. A spigot that poured many minds into one on command. They flowed together and called down the rapture, rolled around the floor and drooled and ululated while their acolytes took notes, and somehow they ended up rewriting the amplituhedron. There was supposed to be some rational explanation to justify the mumbo-jumbo. Left hemisphere pattern-matching subroutines amped beyond recognition. The buggy wetware that made you see faces in clouds or God's wrath in thunderstorms, tweaked to walk some fine line between insight and pareidolia. Apparently, there were fundamental insights to be harvested along that razor's edge, patterns that only the bicamerals could distinguish from hallucination. That was the story, anyway. It sounded like utter bullshit to Brooks. Still, you couldn't argue with the Nobels. Maybe they had some kind of particle accelerator over there after all. They had to be doing something that sucked a lot of energy. Nobody used an industrial vortex engine to run kitchen appliances. From behind, the metallic tinkle of displaced instruments. Brooks turned. His gazers lay in the dirt. On the bench above them, the gutted snake watched him upside down from its dissecting tray. Forked tongue flickering. Nerves, Brooks told himself. The discarded carcass shivered on its back, as if the gash down its belly had let in the cold. Flaps of tissue rippled along either edge of that wound, a slow peristaltic wave undulating along the length of the body. Galvanic response, that's all it is. The snake's head lurched up over the edge of the tray. Glassy, unblinking eyes looked this way and that. The tongue, red-black, black-red, tasted the air. The animal crawled from the pan. It wasn't having an easy time of it. It kept trying to roll and crawl on its belly. But it didn't have a belly. Not anymore. The ventral scales that would have pushed it along, the muscles beneath had been sliced apart. Every one. And so the creature would manage a half-twist every now and then, and fail, and resort to crawling on its back, eyes wide, tongue flicking, insides emptied. The snake reached the edge of the bench, feebly wavered a moment, dropped into the dust. Brooks's boot came down on its head. He ground it deep against the rocky soil until there was nothing left but a moist, sticky clot in the dirt. The rest of the creature writhed, its muscles jumping to the beat of nerves jammed with noise and no signal. But at least there was nothing left that could possibly, please God, feel. Reptiles were not especially fragile creatures. More than once, Brooks had found rattlesnakes on the road hours from the nearest vehicle, spines crushed, fangs shattered, heads reduced to bloody paste, still moving, still crawling for the ditch. The kill sack was supposed to prevent that kind of protracted agony. You turned the animal's own metabolism against it, let lungs and capillaries carry the poison to every cell of every tissue, bringing a quick and painless and, most of all, a complete death. So that it would not wake up and fucking look at you and try to escape
an hour after you'd scraped its insides away. Of course, there were zombies in the world now. Vampires, too, for that matter. But the 21st century's undead were strictly human. There was no reason why anyone would want to build a zombie snake. This had to be another contamination artifact, some accidental genetic hack that shut down the MS receptor sites, maybe triggered a rogue suite of motor commands. Had to be. Still, he'd really hoped the ghosts would be easier to handle out here. There weren't nearly as many ghosts in the desert, for one thing. For another, none of them were human. Sometimes he wished he could feel half as much for the thousands of people he'd killed. Of course, basic biology explained that particular double standard as well. He hadn't had to face any of his human victims, hadn't looked into their eyes, hadn't been there when they'd died. The gut was not a long-range organ. Its grasp of culpability degraded exponentially with distance. There'd been so many arcane degrees separating the actions of Daniel Brooks from their consequences that conscience itself entered the realm of pure theory. Besides, he'd hardly acted alone. The guilt diffused across the whole team. And their intentions, at least, had been beyond reproach. Nobody had blamed them. Not out loud. Not really. Not at first. You don't pass judgment on the unwitting hammer used to bash in someone's skull. Brooks's work had been perverted by others intent on bloodshed. The guilt was theirs, not his. But those perpetrators remained uncaught and unpunished, and so many had needed closure in the meantime. And the distance between how could they and how could you let them was so much smaller than Brooks had ever imagined. No charges had been pressed. It wasn't even enough to revoke his tenure. As it turned out, it was only enough to wear out his welcome on campus. Nature, though. Nature always welcomed him. She passed no judgments, didn't care about right or wrong, guilt or innocence. She only cared about what worked and what didn't. She welcomed everyone with the same egalitarian indifference. You just had to play by her rules and expect no mercy if things didn't go your way. And so Dan Brooks had put in for sabbatical and filed his agenda and headed into the field. He'd left behind his sampling drones and artificial insects, packed no autonomous tech to rub his nose in the obsolescence of human labor. A few had watched him go with relief. Others kept their eyes in the sky. He left them, too. His colleagues would forgive him, or they wouldn't. The aliens would return, or they wouldn't. But nature would never turn him away. And even in a world where every last sliver of natural habitat was under siege, there was no shortage of deserts. They'd been growing like slow cancer for 100 years or more. Daniel Brooks would go into the welcoming desert and kill whatever he found there. He opened his eyes to the soft red glow of panicking machinery. A third of the network had just died in his sleep. 5 more traps went down as he watched. A booster station, suddenly offline. 22 beeped plaintively a moment later. Proximate heat trace, big, man size even, and dropped off the map. Instantly awake, Brooks played the logs. The network was going down from west to east, each dead node another footfall in a growing trail of dark, ragged footprints stomping across the valley, heading directly for him. He pulled up the SATCAM thermals. The remains of the old 380 ran like a thin vein along the northern perimeter, yesterday's stale sunshine seeping from cracked asphalt. Diaphanous thermals and microclimatic hotspots, dying since nightfall, flickered at the threshold of visibility. Nothing else but the yellow nimbus of his own tent at center stage. 21 reported sudden warmth,
and disappeared. Cameras lurked here and there along the trap lines. Brooks had never found much use for them, but they'd come bundled as part of the package. One sat in a booster that happened to be line of sight to number 19. He brought it up. Starlamp painted the nighttime desert in blues and whites, a surrealistic moonscape full of contrast. Brooks panned the view. And almost missed it. A slither of motion from stage right, an amplified blur. Something that moved faster than anything human had any right to. The camera was dead before number 19 even felt the heat. The booster went down. Another dozen feeds died in an instant. Brooks barely noticed. He was staring at that last frozen frame, feeling his gut clench and his bowels turn to ice. Faster than a man, and so much less, and just a little bit colder inside. The field sensors weren't sensitive enough to register that difference, of course. To see the truth from heat signatures alone, you'd need to look inside the very head of your target, to squint until you could see deltas of maybe a tenth of a degree. You'd look at the hippocampus and see that it was dark. You'd listen to the prefrontal cortex and hear that it was silent. And then maybe you'd notice all that extra wiring, the force-grown neural lattices connecting midbrain to motor strip, the high-speed expressways bypassing the anterior cingulate gyrus, and those extra ganglia clinging like tumors to the visual pathways, fishing endlessly for the telltale neural signatures of seek and destroy. It would be a lot easier to spot those differences in visible light. Just look into the eyes and see nothing at all looking back. Of course, if it ever got that close, you'd be dead already. It wouldn't leave you time to beg. It wouldn't even understand your pleas. It would simply kill you, if that's what it had been told to do, more efficiently than any conscious being, because there was nothing left to get in the way. No second thoughts, no pulled punches, not even the basic glucose-sucking awareness of its own existence. It was stripped down to pure reptile, and it was dedicated. Less than a kilometer away now. Something inside Daniel Brooks split down the middle. One half clamped its hands over its ears and denied everything. What the fuck? Why would anyone? Must be some kind of mistake. But the other remembered the universal human fondness for scapegoats, the thousands who'd died thanks to dumb old backdoor Brooks. The odds that at least one of those victims might have been survived by next of kin with the resources to set a military-grade zombie on his trail. How could they? How could you let them? The ATB hissed beneath him as its tires inhaled. The charge cord pulled him briefly off balance before tearing free. He plunged through a gap in the trees and down the scree, skidding sideways, hit the base of the slope, and the desert spun around him, slimy and frictionless. The stream nearly took him out right there. Brooks fought for control as the bike 180'd, but those marvelous marshmallow tires kept him miraculously upright. Then he was racing east across the fractured valley floor. Sagebrush tore at him as he passed. He cursed his own blindness. These days, no self-respecting grad student would be caught dead in the field without rattlesnake receptors in their eyes. But Brooks was an old man, baseline, night blind. He didn't even dare use the headlamp. So he hurtled through the night, smashing through petrified shrubs, bucking over unseen outcroppings of bedrock. He fumbled one-handed through the bike's saddlebags, came up with the gogs, slapped them over his eyes. The desert sprang into view, green and grainy. 0247, the goggles told him from the corner of his eye. 3 hours to sunrise. He tried pinging his network, but if any part of it remained alive, it was out of range. He wondered if the zombie had made it to camp yet. He wondered how close it had come to catching him. Doesn't matter. Can't catch me now, motherfucker. Not on foot. Not even undead.
you can kiss my ass goodbye.
Then he checked the charge gauge, and his stomach dropped away all over again. Cloudy skies, an old battery a year past its best before, a charging blanket that hadn't been cleaned in a month. The ATB had 10 kilometers in it, 15 tops. He braked and brought it around in a spray of dirt. His own trail extended behind him, an unmistakable line of intermittent carnage wrought upon the desert floor. Broken plants, sun-cracked tiles of ancient lake bed crushed in passing. He was running, but he wasn't hiding. As long as he stayed on the valley floor, they'd be able to track him. Who, exactly? He switched from star lamp to infrared, zoomed the view. That. A hot, tiny spark leapt against a distant slope, right about where his camp would be. Closer, though, and closing fast. That thing could run. Brooks swung the bike around and kicked it back into gear. He almost didn't notice the second spark sweeping across his field of vision. It was so faint. He saw the third clearly enough, though, and the fourth. Too distant to make out shapes on thermal, but all hot as humans, all closing. 5, 6, 7. Shit! They were fanned out along the valley as far as he could see. What did I do? What did I do? Don't they know it was an accident? It wasn't even me, for Christ's sakes. I didn't kill anyone. I just left the door open. 10 kilometers. Then they'd be on him like ravenous wolves. The ATB leapt forward. Brooks pinged 911. Nothing. Consensus was live enough, but deaf to his pleas. Somehow he could surf, but not send, and his pursuers still weren't showing up on satellite thermal. As far as the skies could see, he was alone down here with the microweather and the monastery. The monastery. They'd be online. They'd be able to help. At the very least, the bicamerals lived behind walls. Anything was better than fleeing naked through the desert. He aimed for the tornado. It writhed in his enhanced sight, a distant green monster nailed to the earth. Its roar carried across the desert as it always did, faint but omnipresent. For a moment, Brooks heard something strange in that sound. The monastery resolved in the gogs, huddling in the shadow of the great engine. A myriad pinpoint stars burned there against a low jumble of stepped terraces, almost painfully bright. 3 in the morning, and every window was ablaze. Not so faint anymore. The vortex roared like an ocean now, its volume rising imperceptibly with each turn of the wheels. It was no longer stuck to the horizon. Starlamp turned it into a pillar of fire, big enough to hold up the sky or to tear it down. Brooks craned his neck, over a kilometer away, and still the funnel seemed to lean over him. Any second now, it would break free. Any second, it would leap from the ground and slam back down, there, or right fucking here, like the finger of some angry god, and it would rip the world apart wherever it touched. He stayed on course, even though the monster ahead couldn't possibly be made of air and moisture, couldn't possibly be anything so soft. It was something else entirely, some insane Old Testament event horizon that chewed up the very laws of physics. It caught the glow from the monastery, trapped that light, and shredded it, and spun it together with everything else that fell within reach. A small gibbering thing inside Daniel Brooks begged him to turn back, knew that the creatures stalking him couldn't be worse than this, because whatever they were only the size of men, but this was the very wrath of God. But that hesitant little voice spoke again, and this time the question lingered. Why is this thing running so hard? It shouldn't have been. Vortex engines never really stopped. But at night, they weakened in the cooling air, diffused and idled until the rising sun brought them back to full strength. To keep a funnel this size running so hot, so late at night, that would almost draw more energy than it yielded. The vapor from the cooling cells would have to be verging on live steam. And now, Brooks was close enough to hear something else against the jet engine roar. A faint, creaking counterpoint of great metal blades, twisting past their normative specs. The monastery lights went out. It took a moment for his goggles to amp back up. But in that moment of pure, illuminating darkness, Daniel Brooks finally saw himself for the fool he was. For the first time, he saw the pinpoint heat prints ahead of him, closing from the east as well as from behind. He saw forces powerful enough to hack surveillance satellites in geostationary orbit, but somehow unable to blind his antique telonics network to the same heat prints. He saw a military automaton, ruthless as a shark, fast as a superconductor, betraying its own approach from kilometers away, when it could have avoided his trap lines entirely and killed him in his sleep. He saw himself from high overhead, stumbling across someone else's game board, caught in a net that closed around but not on him. They didn't even know I was here. They're after the bicamerals. He pulled to a stop. The monastery loomed 50 meters ahead, low and black against the stars. All windows abruptly shuttered, all approaches suddenly dark. It rose from the landscape as though born of it, a pile of deep rock strata breaching the surface of the world. The tornado loomed beyond like a whirling gash in space-time, barely 100 meters on the other side. The sound of its rage filled the world. On all sides, candles closed in the darkness. 0313, his goggles reminded him. Less than an hour ago, he'd been asleep. It wasn't nearly long enough to come to terms with your own imminent death.
You are in danger, the Gogs told him helpfully.
Brooks blinked. The little red letters persisted, hovering off at the corner of his eye where the chrono readout should be.
Come on then, doors open.
He looked past the command line, panned across the darkened facades of the monastery. There, ground level, just to the left of a broad staircase that underscored the main entrance. An opening, barely big enough for a man. Something burned there at body temperature. It had arms and legs. It waved.
Move your ass, Brooks, you self-absorbed idiot. Ceiling entrance in 15S, 14S, 13S.
Brooks moved his self-absorbed idiot ass. For they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. Hosea, chapter 8, verse 7. Inside, the darkness was bright chaos. Human heat signatures flickered across Brooks's goggles at point-blank range, coruscations of false color in frantic motion. The heat of their passing painted the surroundings with fainter washes of red and yellow. Rough-hewn walls, a flat, dead light panel for a ceiling, a floor that yielded unexpectedly beneath his feet, like some ungodly hybrid of rubber and flesh. Off in an indeterminate distance, something stuttered and wailed. Here in the hallway, the human rainbows moved with silent urgency. The woman who'd invited him in, a petite, writhing heat print no more than 160 centimeters tall, grabbed his hand and pulled him forward.
I'm Liana. Stay close.
He followed, switching the gogs to Starlamp. The heat prints vanished. Bright greenish stars moved in the void left behind. Always in pairs. Binary constellations jostling and blinking in the dark. A word popped into his head. Luciferin. Photophores in the retinas. These people had eyes that doubled as flashlights,
Brooks had once known a grad student with similar augments. Sex had been disquieting in the dark. His guide threaded him through the starfield. That distant wailing rose and fell. Not words exactly, but syllables at least. Clicks and cries and diphthongs in the dark. Bright eyes rose before him, seething with cold blue light. Amplified photons limned a gray face full of lines and angles. Brooks tried to steer his way around, but that face blocked his way. Eyes glowing with such furious intensity that his goggles had to dial back the amplification to almost nothing.
Gelan, the face croaked. Thofe Tesrodia.
Brooks tried to take a step back, bumped into traffic, rebounded.
Eptroth,
cried the face, as the body beneath gave way. Liana pushed him sideways into the wall.
Stay right there,
and dropped to the floor. Brooks switched back to thermal. The rainbows returned. Brooks's assailant was on his back, heat sig bright as a solar flare, muttering nonsense. His fingers fluttered as if stabbing an invisible keyboard. His left foot tapped an agitated tattoo against the elastic flooring. Liana cradled his head in her lap and spoke to him in the same incomprehensible tongue. The chronic background roar of the vortex engine rose subtly in pitch. Stone trembled at Brooks's back. A hot, bright figure appeared down the corridor, swimming against the stream. Within moments, it had reached them. Brooks's guide passed her charge to the newcomer and was on her feet in an instant.
Let's go.
What was
not here?
A side door, a flight of stairs, sheathed in the same rubbery skin that turned their footsteps into soft squeaks. It corkscrewed down through cooling bedrock that dimmed with each step in the goggles' sights. But that compact body glowed like a beacon ahead of him. Suddenly, the world was silent again, but for their own footsteps and the distant, almost subsonic thrumming of the vortex engine.
What's going on? Brooks asked. Oh, Mahmood.
Liana glanced back, her eyes bright, garish blobs, her mouth a crimson slash of heat.
Can't always control when the rapture hits, much less which node. Not the most convenient thing in the world, but you don't want to miss the insights, you know. Could be time travel for all we know. Could be a cure for Golem.
You understood what he was saying.
Kinda. It's what I do when I'm not bringing lost sheep in from the desert.
You're a synthesist? Jargonaut was the street name. Glorified translators, charged with bringing esoteric transhuman tablets down from the mountain, carved in runes simple enough for pitiful baseline humans to half understand. Rona had called them Moses mammals back when she'd been in the world. But Liana was shaking her head.
Not exactly. More of a... You're a biologist, right? Synthesists would be rats. I'm more of a koala bear.
Specialist, Brooks nodded. Narrower niche.
Exactly.
A faint orange stain appeared on the thermoptics, warmth from below. And you know who I am because...
We're on the bleeding edge of theistic virology here. You think we don't know how to access a public database?
I just thought you'd have better things to look up when you were being attacked by zombies.
We keep an eye on the neighborhood, Dr. Brooks.
Yeah, but what... She stopped. Brooks nearly ran into her, then realized they'd reached the bottom of the stairs. Bright heat spilled around a corner dead ahead. Liana turned and tapped his goggles.
You won't be needing those.
He pushed them onto his forehead. The world reverted to a dim wash of blues and grays. The rough stone to his left broke the feeble, ambient light into jagged fragments. To his right, the wall was smooth gray metal. Liana was already past him, heading back up the stairs.
I gotta go. You can watch from down here.
But... Don't touch anything, she called back, and was gone.
He stepped around the corner. The ceiling panels here were as dead and dark as every other he'd seen in this place. The room, really more of a cul-de-sac, was lit solely by a band of smart paint covering the far wall from waist height to ceiling. It glowed with a haphazard collage of tactical displays, ranging from hand size to 2 meters across. Some of the feeds were coarse green mosaics, others rendered images, high res and razor sharp. A man in a loose tan coverall paced back and forth before the displays, at least 2 meters from his fuzzy slippers.
Slippers?
To the cropped salt and pepper thicket on his head. He spared a glance as Brooks approached, muttered,
Glass knot,
and turned back to the welter of intel.
Great.
Liana the Koala had told him he could watch, though. He stepped forward and tried to make sense of the chaos. Upper left, a satellite view so crisp it nearly hurt his eyes. The monastery sat dead center, a bullseye on the board, aglow with telltale thermal emissions. But it was the only hot spot in the whole window. Whatever orbital eye he was looking through had been precisely blinded to all those other heat prints closing in the darkness. Brooks reached for the display, his fingers set to zoom the mag, a grunt and a glare from the slippered monk, and he desisted. So much for orbital surveillance. The monastery had its own cameras, though, judging by the mix of star lamp and thermal windows looking out across the desert. They painted the nightscape in palettes from every band of the visible spectrum. Cool blues and rubies intense as lasers. Color schemes so chaotic, Brooks wondered whether they were really functional or just a reflection of some deviant bicameral aesthetic. Candles glowed in each of those windows, and they all looked the same. 4 clicks out, and closing fast. Something sparkled on one of the displays, a tiny bright sun dog in the dead of night. The image flared a moment. Bright electronic snow fuzzed the display. A brief, bright nova. Then a dark, dead hole in the wall. No signal, flashing from its center. The monk's fingers flew across the paint, calling up keyboards, zooming displays. Windows sprouted, panned brief landscapes, evaporated in turn. 3 of those views sparked and died before the bicameral had the chance to retire them gracefully. They're taking out our cameras, Brooks realized, and wondered, distantly, when he had started to think of these rapture-stricken deviants as part of we. Less than 3.5 kilometers now. A new set of windows bloomed across the wall. The pictures flickering in these frames were grainier than the others, desaturated, almost monochrome. And while they too panned the desert, there was something about those views, something different yet familiar. There. 3rd window over, a tiny monastery hunkered on the horizon, a tiny vortex engine. This camera was looking back from way the hell across the desert. That's my network, Brooks realized. My cameras. I guess the zombies left some alive after all. Brother Slippers had tapped into a half dozen of them, zoomed and cycled through each in turn. Brooks wasn't sure how useful they'd be, cheap, off-the-shelf things, party favors, to lure impoverished researchers into springing for a package deal. They had the usual enhancements, but the range was nothing special. They seemed to be sufficient for Slippers' purposes, though. 2nd window from the left, a heat source moved left to right, about 100 meters out. The camera panned automatically, tracking the target while he amped the zoom. The image resolved in slow degrees. Another one of the monastery's eyes flared and died, its overlaid rangefinder fading a moment later, 3.2 kilometers. That's almost 9 meters per second. On foot. What happens when they get here? He asked. Slippers seemed more interested in a distant heat print caught on number 3. A small vehicle, an ATB, same basic design as...
Wait a minute. That's my bike, Brooks murmured, frowning. That's me. Slippers spared him a glance and a headshake.
Assub.
No, listen. It was far from a perfect mugshot. And Telonix's Steadicam tracking algorithms were the envy of no one in the field. But whoever sat astride that bike had Brooks's mustache, the square lines of his face, the same multi-pocketed field vest that had been years out of style, even when he'd inherited the damn thing 2 decades before. You're being hacked, Brooks insisted. That's some kind of recording. Someone must have... Someone was recording me? I mean, look at it! 2 more cameras down. 7 so far. Slippers wasn't even bothering to clear the real estate by closing the channels. Something else had caught his eye. He tapped the edge of a window that looked onto a naked-eye view of the desert sky. The stars strewn across that display glittered like sugar on velvet. Brooks wanted to fall into that sky, get lost in the stark, peaceful beauty of a night without tactical overlays or polarized enhancements. But even here, the monk had found something to ruin the view. A brief flicker, a dim red nimbus framing an oval patch of starscape for the blink of an eye. The display clicked softly, an infinitesimal sharpening of focus, and in the next instant, the stars returned, unsullied and pristine. Except for a great hole in the night hanging over the western ridge, a vast dark oval where no stars shone. Something was crawling toward them across the sky, eating the stars as it went. It was as cold as the stratosphere. At least, it didn't show up on any of the adjacent thermal views. And it was huge. It covered a good 20 degrees of arc, even though it was still... No rangefinder. No heat print. If not for whatever microlensing magic Slippers had just performed, not even this eclipse of ancient starlight would have given it away. I, Brooks realized, have definitely picked the wrong side. 2,300 meters. In 5 minutes, the zombies would be knocking at the door.
Carousel,
Slippers murmured, and something in his voice made Brooks look twice. The monk was smiling, but he wasn't looking at the cloaked behemoth marching across Orion's belt. His eyes were on a ground's-eye view of the vortex engine. There was no audio feed. The tornado whirled silently in the star-lamped window, a shackled green monster tearing up airspace. Brooks could hear it anyway, roaring in his memory, bending the ducts and the blades of the substructure that birthed it, vibrating through the very bedrock. He could feel it in the soles of his feet. And now, Brother Slippers brought up a whole new window, a panel not of camera views or tactical overlays, but of engineering readouts, laminar feed, and humidity injection rates, measures of torque and velocity, and compressible flow arrayed along 500 meters of altitude. Offset to one side, a luminous wireframe disc labeled VEC/Prime sprouted 1,000 icons around its perimeter. 100 more described spokes and spirals toward its heart. Heating elements, countercurrent exchangers, the devil's own mixing board. Slippers nodded as if to himself.
Watch.
Icons and outputs began to move. There was nothing dramatic in the readouts, no sudden acceleration into red zones, no alarms, just the slightest tweak of injection rates on one side of the circle, the gentlest nuzzle of convection and condensation on the other. Over in its window, the green monster raised one toe.
Holy shit! They're going to set it free!
A wash of readouts turned yellow. In the heart of that sudden sunny bloom, a dozen others turned orange. A couple turned red. With ponderous, implacable majesty, the tornado lifted from the earth and stepped out across the desert. It came down on 2 of the zombies. Brooks saw it all through a window that tracked the funnel's movements across the landscape. Saw the targets break and weave far faster than merely human legs could carry a body. They zigzagged, a drunkard's sprint by undead Olympians. They might as well have been rooted to the ground, The tornado sucked those insignificant smudges of body heat into the sky so fast they didn't even leave an afterimage. It hesitated for a few seconds, rooted through the earth like some great elephant's trunk. It devoured dirt and gravel and boulders the size of automobiles. Then it was off, carving its name into the desert. Back in its garage, swirls of moisture condensed anew where the monster had broken free. The vortex was past the undead perimeter now, veering northwest. It hopped once more, lifting its great, earth-shattering foot into the air. Pieces of pulverized desert rained down in its wake. A distant, disconnected subroutine in Brooks's mind, some ganglion of logic immune to awe or fear or intimidation, wondered at the questionable efficiency of throwing an entire weather system at two lousy foot soldiers, at the infinitesimal odds of even hitting a target on such a wild trajectory. But it fell silent in the next second, and didn't speak again. The whirlwind was not staggering randomly into that good night. It was bearing down on a distant figure riding an ATB. It was coming for him. This isn't possible, Brooks thought. You can't steer a tornado. Nobody can. The most you can do is let it loose and get out of the way. This isn't happening. This isn't happening. I am not out there. But something was, and it knew it was being hunted. Brooks's own hacked cameras told the tale. The ATB had abandoned its straight-line trajectory in favor of breakneck evasive maneuvers that would have instantly pitched any human rider over the handlebars. It slewed and skidded, kicked up plumes that sparkled sapphire in the amped starlight. The vortex weaved closer. They swept across the desert, like partners in some wild and calamitous dance, full of twirls and arabesques and impossible hairpin turns. They were never in step. Neither followed the other's lead, and yet some invisible, unbreakable thread seemed to join the two, pulled them implacably into each other's arms. Brooks watched, hypnotized at the sight of his own imminent ascension. The ATB was caught in orbit now around its monstrous nemesis. For a moment, Brooks thought it might even break free. Was it his imagination, or was the funnel thinner than it had been? But in the next, his doppelganger lost its footing and skidded toward dissolution. In that instant, it changed. Brooks wasn't certain how, exactly. It would have happened too fast, even if whirling debris and the grain of boosted photons hadn't obscured the view. But it was as though the image of Daniel Brooks and his faithful steed split somehow, as if something inside was trying to shed its skin and break free, leaving a lizard tail husk behind for the sky beast to chew on. The maelstrom moved in, a blizzard of rock and dust obscuring any detail. The funnel was visibly weakening now, but it still had enough suction to take its quarry whole, still had teeth enough to smash it to fragments. The undead broke ranks. It wasn't a retreat. It didn't even seem to be a coordinated exercise. The candles just stopped advancing and flickered back and forth in their windows, 900 meters out, directionless and Brownian. Far behind them, the sated whirlwind weaved away to the north, a dissipating, ropey thing, nearly exhausted.
Dymic!
Slippers nodded knowingly.
Asub!
Back on the pad, a newborn vortex chafed at its restraints. Smaller than its predecessor, but angrier somehow. Yellow icons blossomed across Vex/ Prime like rampant brush fires. Overhead, something was eating Gemini feet first. Another window opened on the wall, a hodgepodge of emerald alphanumerics. Slippers blinked and frowned, as though the apparition was somehow unexpected. Greek equations, Cyrillic footnotes, even a smattering of English flowed across the new display. Not telemetry, not incoming. According to the status bar, this was an outgoing transmission. The bicamerals were signaling someone. It all flickered by too fast for Brooks to have made much sense of it,
even if he had spoken Russian. But occasional fragments of English stuck in his eye. Theseus was one, Icarus another. Something about angels and asteroids flashed center stage for a moment and evaporated. More glyphs, more numbers, three parallel columns this time, rendered in red. Someone talking back. Out in the desert, the zombies stopped flickering.
Ha,
Slippers said, and raised a finger to his right temple. For the first time, Brooks noticed an old-fashioned earbud there, an audio antique from the days before cortical inlays and bone conduction. Slippers inclined his head, listening. Up on the wall, a flurry of red and green turned the ongoing exchange into a Christmas celebration. Over on Vex/Prime, orange and red icons downshifted to yellow. The chained vortex stopped thrashing on its pad and whirled smoothly at attention. Halfway to the horizon, the last vestiges of its older sibling dissipated in a luminous mist of settling dust.